Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to BYT Radio. My name is Brandon Weatherby. BYT Radio stands for Brightest Young Things Radio. We are an arts and culture website based out of Washington, D.C., and we also do some coverage in Chicago and New York. Every week here on Full Service Radio at the beautiful Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C., we record on Thursdays, and this special edition of the show features a man who I think has a dream job. It's Jeff Place, the curator and senior archivist at the Smithsonian Folkways. Now, you might know Smithsonian Folkways as the people that do those really great box sets and those really great collections of artists that have long since passed. You might know their Lead Belly box set from a few years ago. It's just fantastic. Well, last Friday they released The Social Power of Music, which is a four-disc collection that is apt for these times, let's say. Now, the Smithsonian Folkways are the same people that do the Smithsonian Folkways Festival, which comes to the National Mall at the end of June and the beginning of July. All of their events are free, and they're going to be doing a year of music all throughout the Washington, D.C. region, including events at places like Songbird, which is around the corner from Full Service Radio in the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan in beautiful Washington, D.C. Let's get to our chat with Jeff Place, curator and senior archivist at Smithsonian Folkways, and then the last segment will be a return to Best Weekend Bets. I think from the kid that used to work in the record store, from the guy that used to run their college radio station, that you have a dream job. Do you have a dream job?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. People talk about that, or I've thought about it, and you know what Venn diagrams are, the circles that meet in little sections and things. I had a background too in doing theater, and that background doing college radio, as you said, and all these things, and then obsessive record collector, all of that, and this job kind of combines like all these disparate things that are passions of mine into this one very small sliver in the middle of the Venn diagrams, and that's my job.
Do you, I'm sorry to go so negative so quickly, but do you feel safety in your job? I mean, were you affected by the government shutdown?
Yeah, I was furloughed, which is really frustrating because I actually produced three major box sets last year, all of which were coming to like the final deadlines right around then. And one was has to do with the 50th anniversary of the New Orleans Jazz Festival, which only is going to happen once in history. And so it kind of put me behind because I was gone for like 5 weeks and I wasn't allowed to even work on my own time. So, yeah, that was, it was really unnecessary.
It's got to be somewhat ironic that the thing that comes out, the first thing after the furlough or the government shutdown that comes out after your furlough is about the social power of music, and you are pretty much handcuffed to do the thing that you love to do.
Yeah. Well, it was frustrating because I just sat there and I really wanted to work on these things or get back to things, and I couldn't even access my email. So it's like, what's going on? These projects that are dear to my heart. And they, people, because a lot of the people I work with here, Smithsonian is partially private money. Mm-hmm. So out of the core group of people who are working on the project, I was the only federal employee. So they all were kind of there. And the person who's the point person wasn't here to control things. And so they were all working it, but I had no idea what was going on, which was kind of, a drag.
This is a good spot to talk about how these things actually come into fruition. So we're here to talk about The Social Power of Music, which is this four-disc box set that was released last Friday. It's currently available on every streaming service as well, Spotify, all that good stuff. And it's a good glimpse into what it advertises, The Social Power of Music. There's a handful of names that people will know regardless of who they are. Everyone knows who Pete Seeger is, but not everyone might know Peggy Seeger, and definitely Disc 4, which is music from not this great country of ours. So how does this come into fruition? How does the sausage get made?
It was a sort of a bigger concept that kind of our office also does the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in the National Mall every year, which is like this year 52, I think, this year. And the festival sort of evolved where it used to be like a country and a state and things like that. And now it's going to have themes each year. So the social power of music became sort of the theme for this year's festival. And then Smithsonian is also doing this giant thing called the Year of Music throughout the entire institution, where they're having at least one musical event every day for the entire calendar year. So this all kind of came as part of this. And so this theme of the social power of music, I was approached, you know, Smithsonian Folkways decided they were going to do a box set book on that. And I was approached because I'm kind of the person who produces almost all the box sets here and over the last 30 years. So, and it was brought to me. So first, you know, I was told, okay, this is the social power of music. I thought, okay, so great. It's all stuff about, you know, music of social justice. I've written a lot about that. That's easy. But then finally I said, no, it's about people and music and social, how music affects like social interaction of human beings. And I'm like, you know, that's like pretty much everything, you know, in day-to-day life. You know, people, you know, you get up in the morning, you might, you know, probably listening to the radio and the car, and it's just music around you and people are interacting with music and all of that. And so how do you try to put that together in one set, you know, trying to illustrate all this stuff? It was a challenge.
It sounds huge. When did this actually start? Let's go through the dates.
Oh, I would think probably, I guess, last summer.
Okay.
So I first started playing around with it.
So, not that long. This is not nearly as, I didn't think it would be this quickly.
Yeah, well, you know, it came around quick because all of a sudden this theme was, you know, it's next year we're doing this festival. We have to have this thing ready, you know. So, last year was the 70th anniversary of, actually it's still this year till May, 70th anniversary of Folkways Records. So we decided we're going to do a rather ambitious release schedule in the 70th year. So it's more stuff that we're doing. I think we're doing something like four box sets this year. So yeah, it was a very busy year for me anyway, working on this stuff.
Is it fair to say that this year's festival theme in this box set is a slightly easier sell than in previous years when you, like you said, it was focused on like one country and usually that country wasn't the most, let's say, popular in the States. Not that they're bad countries at all, just saying that the depth of knowledge is not nearly as deep as, say, like, I don't know, Canada or Great Britain or something like that. It was a little bit more, for the majority of people on the mall, obscure.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you know, the theme thing, yeah, it's more tied together because sometimes we've had these really, like, festivals where, you know, and sometimes we did a Silk Road thing, which in 2002, which is all completely tied together, right, the whole thing. But then one year, I remember, we had the program on NASA, and then next to it was Bhutan. So it's like these things were kind of, you know, really different, you know. So at least tying everything together, you know, in themes is, I think, it's where the festival's going. Makes more sense.
When it comes to this box set, when it comes to what you guys are doing, do you try to include lesser-known artists, or does that even come up in conversation?
I always try to do that. I mean, okay. There's people I, you know, it's funny. This goes back to, like, you know, your first question to me about. I did a lot of, like, back, you know, when I was younger, putting together music for parties and for events, right? Mm-hmm. And you try, and all of a sudden you want to turn people on to, like, people who are obscure, they don't know. And a lot of times they really don't want that. They want things they already know. So I've realized that. So I try to, you know, put a lot of things people already know, but then I try to slide in something that someone they really don't know that they should know. Like this guy, Sammy Walker, who's on the set. And, you know, he was sort of, you know, came out at the same time as John Prine and Steve Goodman and some other people, and he really never, you know, was known as well. And I think that's really, you know, it's good to do, get these people heard.
You included this Peggy Seeger song, which I had never heard before, and it's called Reclaim the Night, and I don't know if I should feel ignorant for not knowing it, or I don't know if I'm a bad ally for not knowing it, but I definitely know of Pete Seeger, clearly, and I know of Peggy Seeger, but I didn't realize she had this very upfront song about sexual assault, and it's pretty early in the box set. I think it's like track 6 or something like that. And what determined that placement? How did you find that song? Was that something you've heard a lot? Have you used that before? Why this song? Why right now?
You know, Peggy Seeger's, she's really well known for a song called I Want to Be an Engineer, which is almost a theme of the women's movement. It's about, you know, a woman who wanted to get a job. You know, an engineer means like person who actually kind of works in a shop, like, you know, lathes and, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to like an engineer, what we think of in British, you know, parlance. And so I was, you know, I was thinking about that. And all of a sudden I ran the list by Tony Seeger, who's Pete's nephew, who I used to work with for 14 years here. And Tony's like, you know, there's that one song that's on the, you know, Reclaim the Night, you know, and I'd heard it before, but I'd forgotten about it. And he said, really, you know, the engineer's been on every record. You should go for that one. And I went and listened to it. I said, yes, he's right. Absolutely. Because that's still happening very much so now, that whole, you know, those rallies. So, yeah, I mean, that was, so once I heard it, I said, yeah, you know, that's absolutely perfect idea.
It's not the most fun song on the record, but it's definitely an important song on the record. This is a fun record for the most part. Of the four discs, it's not that depressing.
Yeah, I tried to, like, you know, get things where, you know, people, the whole point was where people are singing together as a communal thing, you know. You know, I was trying not to really get into, you know, an individual person playing guitar and singing a song. It's more like, you know, Pete singing with an audience and things like that. So there's, you know, there's a disc, which is all sacred music, you know, various religions. And then the one my favorite, I guess, is the one which is sort of a, I was thinking about Sunday morning, you know, kind of the religious thing. And then Saturday night, you know, thinking about Cajun music clubs in Louisiana and conjunto dances in Texas and, you know, contra dancing in like New England and all these kinds of things people do together that include music. So that's kind of the New Orleans music. It's kind of a fun disc.
This is perfect for my next question. You mentioned singing together and you mentioned New Orleans music. So I'm going to mention my favorite track on the four discs, which has no singing on it. It's the Liberty Funeral March by the Liberty Brass Band. Why include this at all? Why even include an instrumental?
Because, you know, the jazz funerals in New Orleans are like, you know, the funerals are second lines and things. So it's definitely community all getting together around the music and like, you know, walking along. And there's a whole body of songs, you know, just Closer Walk with Thee and others that are used in these funerals. And, that, you know, I wanted to get that example, you know, it's certainly a funeral. There's wedding music on there, but a funeral music, and most funerals don't have music really that much, you know. But the New Orleans tradition, they do in these parades. So that's kind of why I wanted that one on there.
What's the one song you want at your funeral?
Oh, geez, I don't know. tough. I have to think about that one.
Is there anything that was left on the cutting room floor? Is there anything, if you had a disc five, that would instantly be track number one?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think how I did it was I envisioned, think of pigeonholes, you know, different themes, like the funeral thing we just talked about. And then I went looking for a song in our, you know, we have this massive collection here of music, which I've been, you know, the curator of now for a long time. I went looking for something that was going to be a perfect thing to fit in that hole. So it wasn't like I had a bunch of extra stuff. It was kind of like, you know, all of a sudden I would say, okay, funeral. And I was thinking, New Orleans stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was also trying to think, too, of, I didn't want it to be all the same thing. For instance, I didn't want it to be like all white men, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to mix up different types of groups of people, you know, in there too. So I was kind of looking for something that would kind of fit, that had all the criteria in mind, right?
Well, the disc that has the least amount of men is disc four, and that theme is global movements. When I first heard and I looked at the playlist, I figured, oh, there's a reason you have Hymn of the Resistance by the Choir of FLN Firefighters, FLN Fighters, close the disc. But is there a reason the Hymn of the Resistance closes the box set?
Well, the last disc, the fourth set, was put together by Meredith Holmgren, who works here, who's a curator of women's music, and she knows a lot about the sort of the international protest music, and we have a record company called Paradon Records, which is primarily that. So she put that together and she sequenced it. So I guess she would be the one who actually decided to put that last.
It sounds it's like a little wink to what's going on right now, maybe.
Yep.
Let's talk. If it's okay with you, I'd like to ask about a different box set of yours.
Sure.
I'm probably not in the minority to tell you that the Lead Belly box set is probably the Smithsonian Folkways project that I've consumed the most, and I probably enjoyed the most. Did you work on the Lead Belly project from a handful of years ago?
Yeah, that's mine.
That is so good.
It's actually part of a trilogy. It started off with a thing called Woody at 100, mm-hmm. in 2012, and then the Lead Belly set, and then the Pete Seeger, the third one, which is actually, to me, I think maybe the best thing I've ever done out of the 60-some-odd projects over the years, is coming out in May, and that's volume three of that set. But I did the Lead Belly one.
Is that easier or more difficult? Because clearly, when you're working on something like this, it's pretty open-ended. It's kind of whatever you make it. But Lead Belly's Lead Belly. There's only so many songs, and there are experts. And same with Woody Guthrie and same with Pete Seeger. There are people that have been fans for their entire life. Is there a different set of responsibility? Do you approach the project differently? Is it different in even any way?
Yeah, it's really different, because I think in the case of those three people I mentioned, our collections here, those are probably the most prominent people in the collections. We have so much stuff on. And I've spent, three decades working with, going through all of the recordings, every Lead Belly recording we have here, and, digitizing them and working with them. And then, for instance, in Lead Belly's case, I went out, and there's certain people who collect things like Lead Belly, right? There are certain Lead Belly collectors. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes the Smithsonian oftentimes collects collectors, because the collectors have already organized all this stuff and it's there, and as opposed to going for individual things. So I went out to some of those people, including the family, went down to Tennessee to the family and went to their other building where they had all the Lead Belly stuff, and just doing this massive focusing on this one thing, this research thing for a while, and then bringing back all the stuff and then kind of going through. That's a case. So you ask about what made Cutting Room Floor, these kinds of projects, I try to identify everything I can find that we have, and then I work backwards. So it's really a lot more focused, and I think it's actually for me a lot more fun to kind of do that kind of project.
You
really immerse yourself in somebody.
You mentioned digitizing. So when this job of yours exists in 100 years, it'll be a little bit different, because in theory, we'll have cleaner audio and better recordings of everything, but clearly for the Woody Guthrie and the Lead Belly stuff and Pete Seeger stuff, especially Lead Belly, you have to digitize this stuff and you have to clean it up. Do you limit yourself? Do you have a set, do you have a standardized cleaning, or could you clean too much?
Well, when you're doing digitization preserving things forever, you never clean.
Okay.
Because what happens is I've been through three or four different generations of the cleaning software and these things. And back when I started here, there was a thing called No Noise that people use on some records. And basically, it got rid of the hiss and all that, but it also got rid of the entire high end of the music. Sometimes you listen to things and certain instruments are missing. If that had been your copy and the original is no longer around, then you're really done yourself in. So the preservation copy keeps all the pops and cracks and noise and stuff, because 100 years from now, who knows what we invented? It might be something that is completely gets rid of it entirely. So consequently, that's what we've done over the years, what I do is, I don't know how long the originals will last for. They might won't be here 100 years, but if they were, it's always nice to have the original to go back to. Mm-hmm. Because the process of copying could be 1,000 times better in 100 years. So that's kind of the rationale, I guess.
How do you consume music? Do you still buy physical music?
Yes. I'm a huge. I don't want to listen to MP3s.
Okay.
I have a high end Bose speakers and stuff like that at home, and I off most of the time I'm listening to vinyl, the old vinyl.
But this, in theory, sounds better on CD.
But tell you the truth, the lead, we're talking about Lead Belly and that stuff. That was recorded originally on instantaneous acetate discs before tape was invented. And some of these glass discs we have, the sound quality off these discs, these analog discs, is just outrageous. You can hear the fingers sliding down the neck of the guitar and stuff. And so I think playing the disc and listening to the disc oftentimes is better than the CD.
So do you think it's do you think it's a format issue, or do you think it was a recording issue and that's why it sounds the way it sounds? Does this make sense?
Well, I've heard theories that when you have digital, you have, you know, your zeros and ones, and no matter how high the sampling rate is, you know, there's less of a gap between those zeros and ones, but there's still a gap. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of those old analog forms have all these waves that go, you know, they're waves between waves and all of that. And somehow I think maybe a little bit of that gets cut out.
Sure.
In the digital realm. So that might be, you know, that's as close as I've heard as people trying to explain the difference, you know, that made sense to me anyway. Now, I still listen to CDs a lot, too, but I'm listening to stuff through, like, computer speakers and stuff. It's just not my thing.
Or, so when
or
you're,
little tiny things.
When you're building these collections, when you're working on the Pete Seeger box set, are you putting on vinyl at home? Are you putting on vinyl in the office? Do you have to listen to the MP3s? How are you doing this?
Well, no. What I've done, all these acetates, we have like CDR reference copies. So, you know, I listen to stuff in my office. I have a system right behind me right here with speakers and all of that. And I play it on the CDs while I'm working on it. When we go in the studio, we put it in the system. We have a, you know, really high-end audio system, you know, with speakers and stuff. We could listen. But that, oftentimes we go back and we retransfer the original disc when we're working on an album. Because no telling, I don't know who recorded, who transferred it the first time, you know, way back when. In the 90s, you probably have better equipment now to do it. But I have a turntable right here next to me in my office, and, you know, a stereo, and I listen to records all day while I'm working.
How often do you replace the needle?
We have a lot of them. I'd say, you know, once a year, maybe, roughly.
If you could recommend a basic system for a home listener, do you have a preferred brand?
Of needles?
Everything. Needle, turntable, speakers.
I don't know. I'm kind of, we have here are Technics turntables, which are like actually really good. You know, they're archival type turntables. They actually will play, you know, if you want to play a record at like 74, you can,
nice.
You know, which is actually interesting because a lot of 78s, believe it or not, when they were released, they're not, the pitch is off because they're not the right speed. They played slightly faster, which made it more peppy. So if you want the, like we found this with the Guthrie stuff. So if you want the exact sound, how Woody Guthrie really sounded, you have to actually knock it down to like 74. I don't know. I don't know what the type of speakers are. Audio guy put them in here. But at home, I have Bose, and I have a Yamaha natural sound amplifier, which, you know, I like, has really low distortion. It's just basically an amplifier, you know. It doesn't have a receiver or anything like that. It's nothing fancy.
You seem to like your life.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, you know, yeah, you know, like I say, each one of these projects is kind of like a little adventure, you know. Go off on that for a while, like I stop and I come back, and then I think the next thing I'm going to work on is a big bluegrass project, so I'll probably be down in Southern Virginia a bunch. So that,
that's,
you know,
great.
And I was in New Orleans last summer, a lot of the summer working on that. So, you know, it's fun.
So when you're working on the bluegrass project, are you looking for new acts as well as old acts, or are you trying to sort of fill in the gaps from our history? Like, we all know the Carter family, and everyone knows the acts that are going to be playing at the DC Bluegrass Festival. Are you trying to fill in those in-between spaces, or are you just trying to highlight all of the things that deserve highlighting?
No, in this case, it's actually, because I work with a lot of historical recordings. You know, the New Orleans thing is actually the one time I've actually worked with people who are kind of still really kind of, it's newer music that's active. The case of the Bluegrass Project is most people consider the 1965 Roanoke Bluegrass Festival to be the first ever bluegrass festival as we know it. You know, the 3 days and people camping and the whole works. There were some one-day bluegrass festivals before that, but this is considered the first, and it pretty much had every major bluegrass band in the country except for Flat and Scruggs and the Osborne Brothers. It was sort of honored to Bill Monroe, and it's, everybody and their brother was at this festival. And bands like old Bill Monroe bands, like Bill Monroe playing with the Carter, Carter and Ralph Stanley, got back together and stuff and played. So we have all the tapes here. There's another set of the tapes down at Ferrum College. So I'm going to go down and work on that, and we're going to try to do some sort of box set about that festival. Because it's one of those festivals where apparently something like 400 people were there, and there's probably 4,000 people who claim they were there. Mm-hmm. including all of the people who were there. A lot of people who were there were like people like David Grisman at 20 years old, who went on to become that. This is where they really kicked them into gear in the bluegrass world, and that's they went on to become the next generation of musicians. This was like a major turning point, kind of the Woodstock of bluegrass, you know. So it's never been released. So that's like I said, I think that's important.
Is there any current artist that you champion? Is there anyone that has released a record in the last 6 months that you're very excited about?
Let me think on that. You know, Don Fleming's Black Cowboy record, actually, it's one I've been listening to over and over. I really, really like. I don't know if the listeners know Don Fleming's, but he was one of the members of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, which is a really important African-American string band that came on, I guess, in about 10, 15 years ago. And now he's solo. He's everywhere. He's quite a character. He always wears a hat and suspenders, and he plays a number of instruments. And so he's really an expert on the history of African-American music in this country. So his record, you know, and fortunately I've been able to do some interview shows with him. That record is a really good one.
If you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
Well, got out of running a record store because I wasn't making enough money to really, besides live in a group house. I mean, I probably would love to do that, maybe, you know. I'd love to, you know, go back to do full-time radio. That'd be fun again, because I think I've amassed a fair amount of knowledge in my head. I probably could put together some really good shows. So I think that would be probably the thing to do.
The Smithsonian, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Smithsonian does not have a radio station. Is that correct?
Not now. They had one when I started here in the 80s.
Okay.
Called Radio Smithsonian. One of the people who worked there, Marika Partridge, now went on and has a station in Tacoma Park, Maryland. You know, and other Nick Spitzer, who was one of the people on that, now has a show called American Roots on NPR. So it kind of broke up, and they stopped having it. But we had a little show we did out of here for a while called Sound Sessions, which was broadcast. It's still broadcast on a couple stations, the old shows anyway, around the country. But we brought like musicians would come through here, and we'd sit down and we'd interview them and do a show, you know, while they were here. So it was really kind of a lot of fun, but kind of fizzled out.
Seems like a missed opportunity considering where podcasts are right now and your breadth of knowledge and your actual catalog. And if they had somebody like you that could pull a song that, I don't know, like yesterday, if you're listening to this in the future, yesterday was the Michael Cohen testimony in the House committee. If there was a song that kind of related to that about a lawyer or something from the 40s, like you could be the guy that pulls that. And now there's that connective tissue between the past and the present. Just saying, it's a lost opportunity.
War and Zeev on lawyers, guns, and money.
There you go. Sure.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for someone that wants your job? I'm not trying to get you fired. I'm not trying to get you to lose your job. But for the kid that wants this job, what do you recommend?
Well, you know, I think the real ticket that got me in here was the Master's in Library Science, specializing in sound archives. That was kind of the actual nuts and bolts thing that got me here. And then, you know, what made it a lot better is just the background of, you know, I just, ever since I was like, you know, whatever, teenager, 15 or something, I've been collecting, you know, just like soaking in music and records, just like, you know, I constantly, you know, just having that passion, you know, and be able to sort of channel that passion, you know, by being in a place like this. And, you know, yeah, so I think there's every so often are people who come through here, young people who are like, you know, interns and stuff. I can see, you know, maybe me after I'm gone. You know, we'll see what happens.
This is not just about the box set. The box set is obviously available to listen and to buy and to stream and all that good stuff. But like you said, there's going to be events throughout the entire year. Where can people find those events?
Well, I mean, I just would, you know, go online and search, you know, Smithsonian Year of Music. Mm-hmm. There's a calendar. And, you know, it's supposed to be at least one a day, but a lot of times it's like a lot of times, you know, like weekends, a lot of them.
We record this out of the Line Hotel in beautiful Adams Morgan, right around the corner is Songbird. One of the events was at Songbird. It's mostly in D.C. proper. It really works out. And I think they're all free as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's Smithsonian, so it has to be free.
There
yeah,
you go.
Absolutely.
And the Folklife Festival returns. It's end of June into the first part of July. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the usual schedule.
Is there anyone that you're excited about this year?
You know, I haven't seen the list yet. you know, I'm hoping that, you know, some New Orleans people come up. I don't know. But, you know, I don't work directly on that. So I don't think they've announced the people yet. And I got all kind of really messed up by the furlough and the shutdown, because that was right when a lot of those people were on contract who were doing, you know, the research around the country, and they, you know, didn't get paid and didn't have a job. So anyway, so I haven't seen who's there yet, so it's hard to say.
Unfortunately, that's actually the perfect way to tie a bow on this thing. It started with the shutdown and ends with the shutdown, and that stuff affects a lot of people in ways that you don't really think about.
Yeah, there was one of the women working on research at the festival, Whitney Brown, was like, she was all over television, even here in Canada, talking about being this single woman, like, you know, working, you know, without, she just lost all her paychecks and, you know, and trying to make things. She ended up working at, like, some friends of hers hired her, like, a distillery or something to help move bottles around or something, so she just had some money in her pocket. So, yeah, it really affected people.
Jeff, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for talking.
I want to thank Jeff for taking time out of his day to have a chat with us. Great guy, great conversation. Pick up the box set, listen to it on Spotify, do whatever you need. It's called The Social Power of Music. It's available wherever fine records are released. The music you're hearing underneath us right now is the Liberty Funeral March by the Liberty Brass Band. We spoke about that in the middle of our chat. I love this song. It's kind of maudlin, but it's not really, because it's New Orleans and nothing's that sad in New Orleans, even if it's a tragedy. So I hope that didn't come off as callous or mean. I love New Orleans. This is not a knock on New Orleans. It's the exact opposite. Anyways, every Thursday on Brady Shank Things, we publish our Best Weekend Bets. Best Weekend Bets give you a guide of what to do in Washington, D.C. and New York City and queer Washington, D.C. I'm going to give you three picks for Thursday, three picks for Friday, three for Saturday, and three for Sunday. Do what you will with them. If you want more, go to BradyShankThings.com and remember to sign up for our mailing list so you can get your Best Weekend Bets before anyone else. Now, the reason you might want to sign up before anyone else is because we occasionally have events. For example, we have an event at the Air and Space Museum coming up, and tickets for those are going very, very quickly. We announced them last week, and we're about to sell out of Tier 2 of the ticket packages. So buy your tickets now if you're interested in attending that. Also, our second Death Becomes Us New York City Festival, our first in New York. That sounds very confusing. I'd like to apologize for that. Death Becomes Us, our New York City Festival, is March 20th through 24th. All the info is available at brightestyoungthings.com. We also announced BYT Murder Club. It's at Sun Cinema. It's a Lady Killers edition. Films at Sun Cinemas in March. And Kaylee Dugan and I will be DJing at DC9 on March 10th, which is Daylight Savings Day. It's all time related. It's going to be very silly and very fun. Moving on to this weekend, it's a lot of information. It's all available at productionthings.com. Anyways, Thursday, we're recommending the Cherry Blossom Pop-Up Bar. It is open. It opens tonight. One of the rooms is the most impressive yet. You'll know which one we're talking about when you get there. The Cherry Blossom Pop-Up Bar. Go to BradyShankThings.com to look at photos of that. We're also going to recommend Robin Bell's Open at the Corcoran, because we love Robin Bell on this show, and his art right now is more than apt considering what is going on. We're also going to recommend a free show on the Millennium Stage. Hometown Sounds presents Champion Sound Band. It's a very good Thursday night in Washington, D.C. Moving on to Friday. Friday's an even better night. Benson Ball alum Jonathan Van Ness, you know him as the man with the long hair from Queer Eye. He's going to play a sold-out Kennedy Center. You Me Them Everybody Live, my show, returns to the Wonderland Ballroom with guests Sarah Roach, Haywood Turnip C. Jr., and Weston Smith. And then another friend of BYT, Anthony Parag. You might know him from Janelle and Anthony. Great, great jazz musician. He has two free sets at Black Cat. So that is Friday. All that information is available on BradyShankThings.com. Moving on to Saturday. Saturday, if you are near a computer at any time between 11 a.m. and 10 p.m., I recommend listening to this here radio station, because we're going to be doing a You, Me, Them, Everybody 11-hour marathon. It's not a live show because we don't want you to attend. We just want you to listen from wherever you like to stream things. So that's one of our picks. We're also going to recommend another free show. Grammy-winning Kronos Quartet play a free afternoon set in the Freer. They play at 6th and I later that night. The early day show at the Freer is absolutely free, so that's clearly going to make the list. And then finally, one of the best beer events of the spring, unfortunately one of the most expensive, the Brewers Ball takes over the National Building Museum. It is expensive, but ticket proceeds go to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, so It's a lot of money, but you're doing some good stuff and you're drinking some good beer. So those are our picks for Saturday. Moving on to Sunday, it's the last chance to see the Washington Ballet Sleeping Beauty at the Kennedy Center. Gin World, which is a three-day gin event, kicks off at Service Bar. And we're also going to recommend the first DC United home game of the season. They're taking on the Atlanta United, so it's the United versus the United at Audi Field. For more picks, go to brightestyoungthings.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and have a wonderful night.